Despite the silence, there was a crackling atmosphere of tension down the full length of the cabin. Very few of the passengers, mostly the children, were asleep. But the others sat in rigid rows, their faces taut and strained, watching their captors with a mixture of hatred and of fear. Henri, the Frenchman, slipped into the cockpit. "They're pulling back the armoured cars," he said. He was slim, with a very youthful face and dreaming poet's eyes. He had grown a drooping blonde gunfighter's moustache, but the effect was incongruous. Ingrid looked up at him. "You're so nervous, Sherry." She shook her head. "It'll be all right." "I'm not nervous," he answered her stiffly. She chuckled fondly and reached up to touch his face. "I did not mean it as an insult." She pulled his face down and kissed him, thrusting her tongue deeply into his mouth. "You have proved your courage, often," she murmured. He dropped his pistol onto the desk with a clatter and reached for her. The top three buttons of her red cotton shirt were unfastened, and she let him grope and find her breasts. They were heavy and pointed, and his breathing went ragged as he teased out her nipples. They hardened erect like jelly beans. But when he reached down with his free hand for the zipper of her shorts, she pushed him away roughly. "Later," she told him briskly, "when this is over, now get back into the cabin." And she leaned forward and lifted a corner of the blanket that screened the side window of the cockpit. The sunlight was very bright, but her eyes adjusted swiftly, and she saw the row of helmeted heads above the parapet of the observation deck. So they were pulling back the troops as well. It was nearly time to begin talking, but she would let them stew in their own juice just a little longer. She stood up, buttoned her shirt, and adjusted the camera on its strap around her neck, paused in the galley to rearrange the shiny mass of golden hair, and then walked slowly back down the full length of the central aisle, pausing to adjust the blanket over a sleeping child, to listen attentively to the complaints of the pregnant wife of the Texan neurosurgeon. "You and the children will be the first off this plane, I promise you." When she reached the prone body of the flight engineer, she knelt beside him. "How is he?" "He's sleeping now. I shot him full of morphine," the fat little doctor muttered, not looking at her, so she couldn't read the hatred in his expression. The injured arm was elevated to control the bleeding, sticking up stiffly in its cocoon of pressure bandages, oddly foreshortened with the bright ooze of blood through the dressing. "You're doing good." She touched his arm. "Thank you." And now he glanced at her, startled, and she smiled. Such a radiant, lovely smile that he began to melt. "Is that your wife?" Ingrid dropped her voice so that he alone could hear, and he nodded, glancing at the plump little Jewish woman in the nearest seat. "I will see that she is amongst the first to leave," she murmured, and his gratitude was pathetic. She stood and went down the aircraft. The red-shirted German stood at the head of the tourist cabin, beside the curtained entrance to the second galley. He had the intense, drawn face of a religious zealot, dark, burning eyes, long black hair falling almost to his shoulders. A white scar twisted the corner of his upper lip into a perpetual smirk. "Kurt, everything is all right?" she asked in German. "They're complaining of hunger. We will feed them in another 2 hours, but not as much as they expect." And she ran a contemptuous glance down the cabin. "Fat," she said quietly. "Big fat bourgeois pigs." And she stepped through the curtains into the galley and looked at him in invitation. He followed her immediately, drawing the curtains behind them. "Where is Karen?" Ingrid asked, as he unbuckled his belt. She needed it very badly. The excitement and the blood had inflamed her. "She is resting at the back of the cabin." Ingrid slipped the button that held the front of her shorts together and drew down the zipper. "All right, Kurt," she whispered huskily, but quickly, very quickly. Ingrid sat in the flight engineer's seat. At her shoulder stood the dark-haired girl. She wore the cartridge belt across the shoulder of her bright red shirt, like a bandolier, and she carried the big, ugly pistol on her hip. Ingrid held the microphone to her lips and combed the fingers of her other hand through the thick golden tangle of her tresses as she spoke. 198 British subjects, 146 American nationals. She was reading the list of her captives. There are 122 women on board, and 26 children under the age of 16 years. She'd been speaking for nearly 5 minutes now, and she broke off and shifted in her seat, turning to smile at Karen over her shoulder. The dark-haired girl smiled in return, and reached across to caress the fine mass of golden hair with a narrow, bony hand, before letting it drop back to her side. "We have copied your last transmission. Call me Ingrid." She spoke into the mic with a smile turning into a wicked grin. There was a moment's silence as the controller in the tower recovered from his shock. "Roger, Ingrid. Do you have any further messages for us?"
"Affirmative, Tower. As this is a British aircraft, and as 344 of my passengers are either British or American, I want a spokesman, representing the embassies of those countries. I want him here in 2 hours' time to hear my terms for the release of passengers. Stand by, Ingrid. We will be back to you immediately. We've been able to contact the ambassadors. Don't horse around, Tower."
Ingrid's voice snapped. "We both know damn well that they're breathing down your neck. Tell him I want a man here in 2 hours. Otherwise, I'm going to be forced to put down the first hostage." Peter Stride was stripped down to a pair of bathing trunks, and he wore only canvas sneakers on his feet. Ingrid had insisted on a face-to-face meeting, and Peter had welcomed the opportunity to assess at close range. "We'll be covering you every inch of the way there and back," Colin Noble told Peter, fussing over him like a coach over his fighter before the gong. "I'm handling the gunners personally." The snipers were armed with specially hand-built .222 magnums with accurized barrels that threw small light bullets with tremendous velocity and striking power. The ammunition was match-grade, each round lovingly hand-finished and polished. The infrared telescopic sights were readily interchangeable with the laser sights, making the weapon deadly accurate, either in daylight or at night. The bullet had a clean, flat trajectory up to 700 yards. They were perfectly designed man-killers, precision weapons that reduced the danger to bystanders or hostages. The light bullet would slam a man down with savage force, as though he'd been hit by a charging rhinoceros, but it would break up in his body and not over-penetrate to kill beyond the target.
"You're getting into a lather," Peter grunted. "They want to talk, not shoot. Not yet, anyway."
"The female of the species," Colin warned. "That one is real poison." "More important than the guns are the cameras and sound equipment. I went up there and kicked a few arses. You'll get pictures that'll win you an Oscar. My personal guarantee." Colin checked his wristwatch. "Time to go. Don't keep the lady waiting." He punched Peter's shoulder lightly. "Hang loose," he said. And Peter walked out into the sunshine, lifting both hands above his shoulders, palms open, fingers extended. The silence was as oppressive as the dry, fierce heat, but it was intentional. Peter had frozen all air traffic and had ordered the shutdown of all machinery in the entire terminal area. He didn't want any interference with his sound equipment. There was only the sound of his own footfalls, and he stepped out briskly. But still, it was the longest walk of his life, and the closer he got to the aircraft, the higher it towered above him. He knew that he had been required to strip almost naked, not only to ensure that he carried no weapons, but to place him at a disadvantage, to make him feel ill at ease, vulnerable. It was an old trick. The Gestapo always stripped the victim of an interrogation, so he held himself proud and tall, pleased that his body was so lean and hard and muscled like an athlete's. He would have hated to drag a big, pendulous gut and sagging old man's tits across those 400 yards. He was halfway there when the forward door just behind the cockpit slid back, and a group of figures appeared in the square opening. He narrowed his eyes. There were two uniformed figures, no, three, British Airways uniforms. The two pilots, and between them the shorter, slimmer, feminine figure of a stewardess. They stood shoulder to shoulder, but beyond them he could make out another head, a blonde head, but the angle and the light were against him. Closer, he saw that the older pilot was on the right. short-cropped grey curls, ruddy round face. That would be Watkins, the commander. He was a good man. Peter had studied his service record. He ignored the co-pilot and stewardess and strained for a glimpse of the figure beyond them. But it was only when he stopped directly below the open hatch that she moved to let him get a clear view of her face. Peter was startled by the loveliness of that golden head, by the smooth gloss of young, sun-polished skin, and the thundering innocence of wide-set, steady green eyes. For a moment he couldn't believe she was one of them. Then she spoke. "I am Ingrid," she said. "Some of the most poisonous flowers are the loveliest," he thought. "I am the accredited negotiator for the British and American governments," he said, and switched his gaze to the beefy red face of Watkins. "How many members of your commando are aboard?" he asked. "No questions," Ingrid snapped fiercely, and Cyril Watkins extended four fingers of his right hand down his thigh without a change of expression. It was vital confirmation of what they already suspected, and Peter felt a rush of gratitude towards the pilot. "Before we discuss your terms," Peter said, "and out of common humanity, I would like to arrange for the well-being and comfort of your hostages. They are well cared for. Do you need food or drinking water?" The girl threw back her head and laughed delightedly. "So you can dope it with laxative and have us knee-deep in shit? Stink us out, eh?" Peter did not pursue it. The dope trays had already been prepared by his doctor. "You have a gunshot casualty on board?" "There are no wounded aboard," the girl denied flatly, cutting her laughter short. But Watkins made the circular affirmative sign of thumb and forefinger, effectively contradicting her, and Peter noticed the spots of dried blood on the sleeves of his white shirt. "That's enough," Ingrid warned Peter. "Ask one more question and we'll break off." "All right," Peter agreed quickly. "No more questions." "The objective of this commando is the ultimate downfall of the brutally fascist, inhuman, neo-imperialistic regime that holds this land in abject slavery and misery, denying the great majority of the workers and the proletariat their basic rights as human beings." And that, thought Peter bitterly, even though it's couched in the garbled jargon of the lunatic left, is every bit as bad as it can be. Around the world, hundreds of millions would have immediate sympathy, making Peter's task just that little bit more difficult. The hijackers had picked a soft target. The girl was still speaking, with an intense, almost religious fervour, and as he listened, Peter faced the growing certainty that the girl was a fanatic, treading the thin line which divided sanity from madness. Her voice became a harsh screech as she mouthed her hatred and condemnation, and when she had finished, he knew that she was capable of anything. No cruelty, no baseness was beyond her. He knew that she would not stop even at suicide, the final act of destroying the Boeing, its passengers and herself. He suspected she might even welcome the opportunity of martyrdom, and he felt the chill of it tickle up along his spine. They were silent now, staring at each other, while the hectic flush of fanaticism receded from the girl's face, and she regained her breath. And Peter waited, controlling his own misgivings, waiting for her to calm herself and continue. "Our first demand," the girl had steadied, and was watching Peter shrewdly now. "Our first demand is that the statement I have just made be read on every television network in Britain and the United States, and also here upon the South African network." Peter felt his loathing of that terrible little box rise to the surface of his emotions. That mind-bending electronic substitute for thought, that deadly device for freezing, packaging and distributing opinion. He hated it, almost as much as the violence and sensation it pervaded so effectively. "It must be read at the next occurrence of 7 p.m. local time in Los Angeles, New York, London and Johannesburg. Prime time, of course, and the media would gobble it up hungrily, for this was their meat and their drink, the pornographers of violence.